This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from the October 2025 issue of Arizona Highways. L.M. Boyd is the author of Transit Cycles. I want to get people stoked on bikes, says Jenna Maturzak, who got stoked herself as a kid growing up in Western New York. Now she has her own bike shop, one that carries a wide selection of bike packing, touring, and commuter gear, including racks, panniers, and frame bags. Jenna Maturzak likes taking things apart. She always has. Before she was the owner and service manager at Transit Cycles, a bike repair shop in Tucson's Mercado San Agustin district, Maturzak rode her bicycle with neighborhood kids in Buffalo, New York, where she grew up. More than once, she ran into maintenance issues that sent her to repair shops until her father told her that instead of a repair shop, they'd be visiting the library. I'm going to get you some books, her father said. We're going to get you a little tool set. I'm not paying anybody to fix this stuff anymore. That started the long path that led Maturzak to Tucson, where she's lived since 2016. And now she's the one getting paid to fix bikes. She was a natural fit for Transit Cycles, which Duncan Benning opened in 2014. The shop is in the MSA Annex, which also houses locally owned eateries, bars, and other shops, all in modified shipping container. Transit Cycles carries popular and specialty bike brands including Esker Cycles, State Bicycle Company, Surly Bikes, and Salsa Cycles. It's also the main dealer in Southern Arizona for special orders from the Revel Bikes, Omnium Cargo Bikes, and Extra Cycle brands. The inventory changes frequently, but the shop maintains a floor full of ready-to-go builds. As for repairs, the shop staff is able to service and maintain all kinds of bicycles, whether they're decades-old road bikes or modern builds. They also handle e-bike repairs from major brands. Customers planning a more involved cycling trip will find a wide selection of bike packing, touring, and commuter gear such as racks, panniers, frame bags, and accessories. The shop's staff helps customers outfit their bikes based on riding goals, Maturzak says, whether those involve adventure touring or daily commuting. During the COVID-19 pandemic, the bicycle industry boomed. When gym doors closed, people were eager to dust off a set of wheels from the garage, Maturzak says. Benning called me several times a week saying, I have suspension work for you. I have wheel builds for you. Can you help me out? Maturzak was already working full-time elsewhere, but when a friend asks for help, you help, she says. And as weeks of extra work turned into months, Benning posed another question. Would Maturzak be interested in buying him out? My first reaction was, hell no, she says. But she gave it more thought, did her research, and eventually took a chance on owning a small business during a pandemic. She wrote a check to Benning in January 2021. Now, Transit Cycles is a woman-owned and operated bike shop, a badge Maturzak wears with pride. She also credits her staff with fostering a welcoming, professional space, both among the team and with customers. I want to get people stoked on bikes, she says. My job is to make sure that whoever brings their bicycle to me, and whatever kind of bicycle it is, that they get it back in proper working order. My first inclination is, you already have this bike. If you love it, if it means something to you, let's fix it. The employees at Transit Cycles approach each customer with the same level of professionalism, no matter what their experience level might be, Maturzak says. Supporting the Tucson bicycle community is important to her, whether her customers are participants in the Tour de Tucson or more casual cyclists. We take care of them and we treat them the same way, she says. Everybody gets treated with respect. Cycling is for everybody, she adds. You don't have to be fast. You don't even necessarily have to be good at it. If you enjoy riding bikes and having fun, that's what matters. Transit Cycles is located at 267 South Avenida del Convento, Building 10 in Tucson. Phone number 520-396-4525. Website transitcycles.com. And this concludes Transit Cycles. Lauren Cisneros is the author of This Is My Story. This story was adapted with permission from Ms. Cisneros' Facebook posts from July 26th and 27th, 2025. Lately, I've been pushing myself to step outside and document the Dragoon Bravo fire on the north rim of the Grand Canyon from the south rim, trying to process something that still feels surreal. On Friday, July 11th, my partner Dave and I had to rapidly evacuate the north rim, where he worked for Grand Canyon National Park and I worked remotely as marketing coordinator for Grand Canyon Conservancy, the park's nonprofit partner. Somehow, within 10 minutes of going from set to go evacuation status, we managed to throw most of our things into our camper and truck. We left our hot tub, which somehow survived untouched, and our tent, along with some miscellaneous items. The tent burned to the ground, and the fire was so hot, it burned a giant hole through our outdoor freezer. The thing I'm most sad about losing is my first park ranger flat hat, which I'd hoped to wear when we got married. But that's nothing compared to our friends who lost everything. We've evacuated for hurricanes before, but with those, you have days to prepare. When you're given just minutes, it's traumatic and hard to process. Many of us who evacuated to the South Rim feel like we're in a strange version of reality, still trying to figure out what day or time it is. We're thankful to have housing here, that my job is remote and giving me time off, and that Dave has work here when he's ready. The media coverage has been tough. So much focus has been on Grand Canyon Lodge burning down. Yes, that's a loss, but it also burned down in the 1930s and it will be rebuilt. I wish the news told the stories of the people who lived there, the ones who made the North Rim what it was for visitors. Our friends lost everything. Cabins flattened, every personal item that wasn't carried out gone. The North Rim was our summer home for 5 seasons. It meant so much to us. It was the first park Dave and I ever worked in together, and the only one we returned to again and again because we loved it. Most seasonal employees move on after 1 season. We didn't. I'm so thankful for those 5 seasons and for my North Rim friends. We don't know exactly what the future holds, but the North Rim will be rebuilt. And when it is, it will continue to inspire, heal, and welcome others, just as it did for us. I hope that day comes soon. Processing this fire feels like grieving the loss of a loved one. I miss our summer home so much. And this concludes This Is My Story. Nikki Buchanan writes about Los Milix Vineyards. In 2024, Pavli and Ida Milix, the husband and wife team behind Los Milix Vineyards in Elgin, opened 9 lovely casitas on their 20-acre property, each one looking out over 12 acres of planted grapevines. It's their way of providing gracious accommodation right in the heart of Southern Arizona wine country to enophiles who prefer to sip and savor at their leisure rather than scurry from tasting room to tasting room, then drive home in a possibly besotted state. Relax, enjoy the wine, and truly get away. That's the Los Milix mantra. The setting is quintessential Southern Arizona, rolling hills and grasslands, big sky. If life imitates art, these are Ed Mel paintings and stunning views of the rugged Mustang and Whetstone Mountains. The star of this extravagant nature show is the Mustang's northernmost peak, Mount Bruce, locally referred to as the Biscuit for its softly rounded summit. There isn't a telephone pole in sight. The air smells fresh, and the immense quiet is broken only by birdsong or the soft whisper of wind through the vines. A visitor's first look at Los Milix invariably impresses. Monolithic metal-plated panels, bronze-colored and vaguely brooding, rise from the prairie like a modern-day Stonehenge, marking the entrance to the tasting room. The Milix described them as an art installation intended to complement the landscape. With their corrugated metal exteriors designed to rust and create a patina that blends with the terrain, the casitas exude a similarly elemental yet modern vibe. They're essentially small, sleek homes, each unit containing a living room, galley kitchenette, sans stove but with wine fridge, bath with walk-in shower, dining area, and workspace whose cupboard holds a Murphy bed. In the living room, a comfy king bed descends from the ceiling at the touch of a button. Given the spectacular view of Mount Bruce from this vantage point, there's really no reason to ever leave that bed, although drinking coffee on the deck and watching the sun come up over the mountains is pretty fabulous too. Fruit, cereal, granola, milk, yogurt, and freshly baked muffins are provided for a do-it-yourself breakfast. Fittingly, the winery's tasting room, which is in fact a full-blown dinner restaurant, is named The Biscuit. Its floor-to-ceiling windows offer yet another close-up of its namesake, and there's a shaded patio to catch the breezes. Los Milix wines, and there are already award winners among them, are offered by the glass, bottle, or five-wine flight. Meanwhile, executive chef Trevor Routman plies customers with beautifully presented modern American cuisine, including a spectacularly good bread course. When a serene, wine-wonky getaway is a goal, Los Milix is a place. Eat, drink, sleep, repeat. Los Milix Vineyards is located at 423 Upper Elgin Road in Elgin, phone number 520-373-2074, website losmilixvineyards.com. And this concludes Los Milix Vineyards. Kathy Montgomery is the author of Whip Into Shape. In 1986, a state penitentiary in Colorado launched a program to train wild horses. 3 decades later, Arizona did something similar. Known as WHIP, the Wild Horse Inmate Program, the initiative helps prepare wild burros for adoption while teaching participants life skills they can use when they get out. The burro in the round pen eyes her companions in the adjoining corral. Halter firmly in hand, a trainer guides the Jenny past them, stopping to rub her neck generously before leading her a few more steps forward. This Jenny is newer and just learning how to lead, head trainer Indy O'Connor says from atop a dappled gray Mustang. The trainer gently pulls the lead in the direction he wants the burro to go, creating pressure on her face. When she takes a step, the trainer releases. So we're teaching the donkey that the good deal is to follow, O'Connor says, and the bad deal is you get pressure. On this day, most of the wild burros at the Florence Correctional Center training facility, southeast of the Phoenix area, are newer, as are the incarcerated men learning to train them. Some of the more experienced trainers earned their release from prison around the time the burros they gentled were adopted. Of the 4 men in the pen, the most experienced has been in the program for 9 months. The newer trainers, about 2 months. We hook up guys who are new with guys who have been here for a while, O'Connor says, so they also learn how to be part of a team. The trainer hands the lead to one of the newer men. Although he's muscle-bound and tattooed, he has more trouble getting the burro to follow. Both he and the burro find themselves in a similar position. They're learning something new in a place they didn't ask to be. Having that in common is part of what makes this training so successful for man and beast. The Federal Bureau of Land Management oversees most of the wild horse herds in the country, and managing them is one of the agency's biggest headaches. But in Arizona, the bigger challenge is wild burros, of which Arizona has more than any other state. And in every herd management area the BLM oversees in Arizona, the number of burros far exceeds the land's capacity to support them. Those areas include tourist destinations where burros have become a nuisance at campgrounds. They also damage crops and linger on roadways. Over 100 have been hit by vehicles in the last year, says John A. Hall, Arizona's wild horse and burro program lead. That's a result of people feeding them from vehicles, approaching them, and giving them water. It leads to them hanging out in places they shouldn't be, Hall says, and when that happens, the BLM has to remove them. Most of the burros captured in Arizona are prepared for adoption at the BLM's holding facility in Florence, the agency's only such facility in the state. From there, some of them are shipped to adoption events around the country or elsewhere in Arizona. Others are placed with burro rescue organizations for their training programs, and a small number are trained by people incarcerated at the nearby prison. The partnership between the BLM and the Arizona Department of Corrections is one of a handful of efforts around the country. Collectively, these efforts make up the Wild Horse Inmate Program, or WHIP. Typically, 50 to 75 burros per year are trained in the prison program, a relatively small number, but enough, Hall says, to show that these wild animals are trainable. The program also gives incarcerated people a job that can be rewarding and likely is different from anything else they've done. In the process, participants learn life skills that can help them be successful once they're released. The idea of using therapeutic animals in institutions isn't new. The first recorded instance was in 1919 when a government mental hospital brought in a dog as an experimental playmate. And a 1975 study at a hospital for the criminally insane found that patients in a ward with access to pets required half the medication as and experienced less violence than those in an otherwise identical ward. In 1986, a state penitentiary in Cannon City, Colorado, was among the first prisons to develop a wild horse program, and it quickly inspired similar programs in other Western states. When the Florence prison began considering a whip program in 2011, the BLM reached out to Randy Helm. The pastor and former undercover narcotics officer grew up in a ranching family and bought his first Mustang from the agency in 1994. He eventually became involved with adoption centers, running clinics to teach potential adopters how to gentle a Mustang. After attending one of those clinics, a Department of Corrections official asked Helm to submit his resume and ultimately hired him to start the Florence program. Helm spent his first 6 months putting policies, procedures, and infrastructure in place. He also visited other programs, including Canyon Cities. The program officially launched in May 2013. Arizona has a huge population of wild burros, Helm says, so we'd bring the burros over and start training them, first gentling them and then training them for pack. The prison's industrial yard fabricated a burro cart for cart training. Larger burros also got saddle trained. And if the program was unconventional, so was the training. Traditionally, training horses and burros involves correcting them to produce a desired behavior. Helm turned that method on its head, employing a progressive system based on trust. The system works for both horses and burros, although burros require a slightly different approach. Horses you train off of movement, you can get them to do anything and help them figure out what you're asking them to do, Helm says. But a donkey wants to see your resume first. And while horse training begins with a lot of work as in a round pen, Helm says, burros go around one time and go, okay, I have no idea why you're asking me to go around again. I saw the whole thing. But burros gentle faster and form deep bonds. Trainers often describe them as having the same temperament as a dog, curious, friendly, and loyal. They also protect livestock from predators such as coyotes and bobcats. Some adopters use them as pack animals, but most keep them as companion animals or pets. O'Connor first took over the training after Helm retired in 2020, and while he has a different mentor, he employs the same basic philosophy. We're firm but fair, says O'Connor, who earned his nickname the Hard Way while working with a Mustang named Indy. I thought I knew more than I did, he explains, so I took the name of the horse to remind me that I don't know everything. Firm but fair also summed up the approach to working with incarcerated people, trainers to the staff. Staff members say please and thank you and encourage trainers to treat each other with respect as equals. That's been life-changing for many. There's this quote I really like by Charles Darwin, says Juan V., the trainer who leads the burro team. Human evolution is not based on who's the strongest or the most intelligent, but those willing to change. No matter how smart you can be, you can't outsmart this animal. No matter how strong, that one's going to win. You have to change with them. If I show up one day extremely sad, which translates to anger in me, they will kick me or they will bite me. So I have to come with a positive attitude. Headache or no headache, problems or no problems. And at the end of the day, I can rest calm. I can sleep better. And the next day is going to be better. In 2019, a graduate student at the University of Arizona studied recidivism among WIP participants at Florence. None of the people in the study who had been in the program for a year or more returned to prison in the year after their release. And after 3 years, those in a group closely matched to those in the program returned to prison three times more often. Anecdotally, success stories are legion. We've had a few people who have come through the program and it's been pretty life-changing for them, staff member Mike Lundberg says. Among them is Chris Majorana, one of Florence's first WIP participants. I owe that program everything, says Majorana, who was released in 2013. Part of what the program taught him was discipline. Depending on the time of year, he got up every day at 2 or 4 a.m. to go to work. On the other side is empathy and love, he says. You love these animals. It was an incredible opportunity to find meaning in a change of environment. It changed my whole life. Brandon Paul was in prison for the third time when he joined the program in 2017. What led me there was I turned professional in drinking and drugging, he says. Staring up at the ceiling in Phoenix's 4th Avenue New jail after his final arrest, he recalls, he knew he was done. He just didn't know how he was going to stay that way. The very first day I was at Wild Horse, I had butterflies in my heart, he says, but when he stepped into a round pen with a wild animal for the first time, he felt a sense of peace. I knew at the moment that this is what I was made to do. Working with Mustangs, Paul remained in the program for 4 years. The work taught him patience, but also to communicate by listening to what the horse's behavior was telling him and to think creatively. If you're pushing too hard, you need to take a step back and reassess things, he says. You don't know this horse's history. You have to be compassionate with how they feel because you can't read their minds. I think the program works because these horses have a way of bringing things out of you, especially if you have somebody guiding that experience. Released in 2021, Paul now trains horses professionally. He also does equine therapy with addicts through a rehab program. I found my purpose, he says, and I was blessed to be able to share everything I learned and everything I have. I think that's really what life's all about. And this concludes Whip Into Shape. Next up, some letters to the editor from the October 2025 issue. The article, Neither Hide Nor Hair, in your August 2025 issue was excellent and it piqued my interest in Bigfoot. There's one more historical reference the author could have added, the Jabberwocky monster, as depicted by 19th century English poet and writer Lewis Carroll. To quote a few lines of Jabberwocky, "Beware the Jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Don't say you weren't warned." Submitted by Jeff Franklin of Surprise, Arizona. It is with a grieving soul that I note the devastating irony in receiving your August 2025 issue with its 3 Grand Canyon articles, 2 about the North Rim specifically, in my mailbox the day after the iconic Grand Canyon Lodge and surrounding forest burned down. Now, nearly a month later, neither fire is contained and the Dragon Bravo fire has burned 100,000 acres of pristine forest and is threatening Kaibab Lodge, Buffalo Ranch, and even the entrance station. Forget going to the Thunder River trailhead or locust or fence points because everything is closed. Even though the views will remain the same when it reopens, the journey to them will be forever altered. We can let the U.S. Forest Service, bureaucrats, conservationists, and politicians argue over how the fires might have been handled differently, but they cannot heal the hurt in our hearts over such an enormous loss. Submitted by Kathleen Norris of Cave Creek, Arizona. The editor's letter, August 2025, about Robert Steve's rim-to-rim hike to celebrate his brother's 60th birthday encouraged me to revisit my 60th birthday hike in the Grand Canyon, which I did with my wife and another couple who had never hiked there. It was 9 degrees with snow and ice at the trailhead, and down in the canyon with the red buds blooming, it felt like springtime. Now, with the wildfire destruction of the forest and the lodge in the North Rim, I've listened to Arizona Highway's 3-part podcast series, Stories from the North Rim. Steve Goldstein's and Robert Steve's conversations with Bruce Aiken, Tom Myers, and Amy S. Martin are a beautiful tribute to the North Rim, insightful and very moving. I wonder if the large ponderosa pines on the Wood Forest Trail survived this fire. Thanks for encouraging positive conversations with your photos, words, and voice. Submitted by Fred Nelson of Des Moines, Iowa. Kat Weaver of Ventura, California wrote, I thoroughly enjoyed Craig Charles' essay, Forested Highlands, July 2025. His vivid recounting of his experiences in the forest brought back memories of good times had in the summers of my youth. Charles' writing not only captures the beauty of the forest and neighboring Grand Canyon, but also underscores the profound responsibility we share in preserving such pristine environments for future generations. His blend of insight, intimacy, and respect for the land makes this one of the most memorable essays I've read in Arizona Highways. Thank you for including voices like Craig Charles, which illuminate the state's untamed corners with wonder, environmental awareness, and personal experience. Well, you've done it again. Just as I was getting over my homesickness for Arizona, my adopted home state, you published another exceptionally fine edition, July 2025, and my homesickness has returned. Of course, I'm joking, but only to a certain extent. I do miss Arizona a lot, having made my permanent home there for 26 years and intending to never leave, but at the age of 80, I returned to my roots in Pennsylvania. Thank you for your magazine with its extraordinary photos and fine articles, submitted by Russ Kessing of Mansfield, Pennsylvania. The scenic drive for October 2025 is Charleston Road, article written by Noah Austin. Belgium has the Battle of the Bulge, one of the most significant conflicts in Europe during World War II. You probably heard of it. Arizona has the Battle of the Bulls, which might have been the least significant conflict of the Mexican-American War. If you somehow haven't heard of that one, it's probably because you haven't been down Charleston Road, which connects the communities of Tombstone and Sierra Vista. That unusual footprint in Arizona lore is just part of the history along this easy desert meander. Just west of the OK Corral in Tombstone, go south on Sumner Street, which soon bends to the southwest and becomes Charleston Road, a paved two-lane route. Mesquites and ocotillos crowd the roadsides as you descend through the conical buttes of the Tombstone Hills, where a thick vein of silver once fueled the town's mining boom. And around mile two, you'll crest a small hill and get a good look at the distant Huachuca Mountains near this drive's destination. A few tall yuccas join the vegetation as the road approaches the greenery of the San Pedro River, visible miles in advance. At mile 7.6, you'll enter San Pedro Riparian National Conservation Area, which protects 57,000 acres and a 40-mile stretch of one of the only undammed major rivers in the Southwest. Much of the history along Charleston Road is clustered near the river, starting with a pullout on the right at mile 8.5. From there, an easy footpath leads to an overlook of the ruins of the Corbin Mine, once the centerpiece of the 1880s mining town of Millville. As an interpretive sign explains, two stamp mills in the town process silver ore from Tombstone's miners 24 hours per day. The mill workers lived on the other side of the river in Charleston, which boasted blacksmiths, a post office, and a school, among other establishments. Today, a few ruins can be found in Charleston, but there's no trail to that town site, and the Bureau of Land Management, which manages the conservation area, doesn't encourage visitation. The Millville site, though, is relatively easy to visit via a trail network that starts at the overlook. Back on Charleston Road, it's a quarter mile farther to the river crossing and a monument to the 1846 Battle of the Bulls, which involved the Mormon Battalion. As the battalion approached the San Pedro, a group of wild bulls, descended, it seems, from cattle left by Mexican ranchers run off by Apaches, charged the outfit, wounding a few men and killing three mules. The soldiers killed several bulls and drove the rest off, then regrouped and continued their march to San Diego. It's just a few miles from there to the outskirts of Sierra Vista, and a few more miles farther to the road's conclusion at State Route 90. And these days, you're unlikely to see any wild bulls roaming the city streets. That concludes today's readings from Arizona Highways. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.